Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The ACLU has announced that it will represent Benna Aprella. Aprella, a 29-year-old black man, was on a run in West Roxbury earlier this week when he was stopped and questioned by ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. During the interaction, Aprella took out his phone and began recording.
Do you have any, do you have any tattoos on your left and right arm so we can confirm?
Do I have to show you? If I'm free to go, then I'm not showing you anything.
The stop is being described by a number of local elected officials as a clear case of racial profiling. WBUR Shannon Dooling has been covering the story. She joins us now. She's going to bring us the latest. Shannon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So catch us up for folks who missed it. Tell us what happened. I think it was Tuesday was the stop, correct?
That's right. So, okay, so here's what we know. Aprella, who you mentioned, is a 29-year-old black man, a resident of Roslindale, was out jogging in nearby West Roxbury, which is a predominantly white neighborhood, when ICE officers approached him. He says that two SUVs with tinted windows pulled up alongside him. One blocked the sidewalk in front of him, and people, men, white men, came out of the vehicles and started asking him for ID. He told them he wasn't carrying any ID while he was out running. He's trying to get more information from the officers about why he's being stopped. And they tell him it's because he fits the description of someone who's part of an ongoing investigation.
I was struck, Shannon, by how shaken he appears to be in the short video that he recorded. Have you talked to him since the stop?
Yeah, actually, I spoke with him a few hours after he was stopped, and he gave me the play-by-play from his perspective. And he said, of course, this was really unsettling. Let's take a listen to him describe the interaction in his own words.
These guys just hopped out in full camouflage uniforms with masks over their face and stopped me and told me to immediately identify themselves. I was confused as to whether or not they were even legitimate authorities.
So at first, we didn't even know for sure who these officers were. Aprella says they never identified themselves as law enforcement. He says it wasn't until he noticed the letters ICE or ICE on one of the badges. And then he asked if they were immigration. They confirmed, saying that, yeah, we're ICE, which confused him even more because he's a U.S. citizen. He says he's born and raised in Boston.
What has ICE said about the incident, Shannon, and when did they say it?
Well, so we were actually the first at WBUR to confirm that these guys were actually ICE officers yesterday afternoon. And then yesterday evening, ICE sent out more information in a press release. They said their officers were in the area looking for a previously deported Haitian national who they say is wanted on serious drug trafficking charges and has some prior criminal convictions. They even released a photo of the man they said they were targeting, trying to, you know, prove their point that Aprella looks like the man they were looking for.
I noticed in the statement that ICE says the men identified themselves. They say they did identify themselves, and they say it's as, quote, police/ICE, end quote. Those are not the same thing, and especially in light of the angry responses really by a range of Boston officials, I want to ask if it's typical for ICE to equate itself with local law enforcement, to blur these lines between local and federal law enforcement, and are there any restrictions around that?
It's a great question. I mean, you know, you'll see, you know, in images of ICE officers knocking on doors or trying, you know, going after similar targets, as they call them, they will have jackets on that say police on the back, or they'll have, you know, bulletproof vests that say police on the chest. You know, we know a few things about ICE enforcement. We know that generally speaking, when there are large scale investigations in the works, ICE will often communicate with local law enforcement, giving them a heads up, you know, hey, we're going to be in this community on this day. We know ICE officers have a lot of discretion when it comes to executing searches for people they want on immigration and sometimes criminal violations. But we also know that they don't have the right to indiscriminately stop someone randomly on the street and ask them for identification. They do need to have some sort of probable cause. And in this instance, again, they're pointing to this picture of the man they were targeting. saying he looks a lot like Apriella. Of course, we've heard this over and over again, Tiziana. You know, he matched the description, right? It's used frequently, and often it's the basis to stop people of color. We also know ICE doesn't have a right to conceal their identity, as Apriella says they did.
So tell us about the reactions from local officials, from public officials.
Right. Yeah, they came, you know, quickly. The condemnations came over Twitter pretty much as soon as the video was shared on social media. Many of the Boston city councilors are calling for an investigation, calling this blatant racial profiling. Here's what Mayor Marty Walsh had to say yesterday.
Incidents like this have no place in our city, have no place for this in our country, quite honestly. It causes real pain and fear and concern.
So this morning, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents Boston, sent a letter to ICE leadership asking for more information. And actually later this afternoon, Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, along with Congressman Stephen Lynch, also sent a separate letter to ICE leadership saying, you know, we need more information about this incident. And we also want more information about the scope of these types of stops by ICE in and around Boston.
In the wake of the incident, I saw a lot of tweets calling it illegal. City Councilor Andrea Campbell called it an illegal stop. I want to ask, do we know, was it illegal? And have we seen similar stops in the area in the past?
Well, you know, like I said, ICE doesn't have the discretion to stop random people. They need some sort of probable cause. Here, they say it's this photo of their actual suspect. But I think, you know, the most concerning part of this interaction is this dispute over whether the officers ID'd themselves or sought to conceal their identity. You know, there are Fourth Amendment concerns here about, you know, legal stops and seizures, searches and seizures. And there's other constitutional questions around, you know, the use of racial profiling potentially. So there are big civil rights questions here. To be honest, Tiziana, I have not been able to find a legal statute that points to the fact that ICE must identify themselves as federal law enforcement. That's different than, you know, obviously not being able to conceal their identity. So there are a lot of civil rights questions around this. I think it makes a lot of sense that the ACLU of Massachusetts is representing Apriella. That was announced yesterday. They say they're investigating. You know, I think whether this evolves into legal action depends on the results of that investigation.
Shannon, we have a little less than a minute left. Can you put this in larger perspective in your reporting on immigration enforcement?
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you first off, I saw the video, I had no doubts that these could be ICE officers. Immigration officials are in communities performing what they call targeted enforcement actions, making arrests all the time. It's very much a part of their job, whether people like it or not. But generally, they're pursuing these arrests in communities that are not predominantly white, like West Roxbury, right? They're looking for their suspects in places like Lynn or Lawrence or East Boston, where there are more predominantly immigrant communities. I think this case raises serious concerns, not only about potential civil rights violations, but it also brings to light for people who don't live in mostly immigrant communities, hey, these law enforcement officials are out there in communities making these types of stops all the time.
WBUR Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Normally, the day after a debate, the discussion is about that debate, but not in 2020, because less than 24 hours after the only vice presidential debate in a race where one candidate for president has a potentially deadly virus and the other is the oldest nominee in history, the president made new debate news. In response to the decision to make the next presidential debate virtual out of concerns about virus spread, he said this on Fox Business.
No, I'm not going to waste my time on a virtual debate. That's not what debating's all about. You sit behind a computer and do a debate. It's ridiculous. And then they cut you off whenever they want.
Now, ironically, that potentially raises the stakes from last night's vice presidential debate. With future presidential debates unsettled, it is at least possible that last night would be the last time the two campaigns face off before Election Day. So, did Massachusetts learn what we need to learn? Let's talk about that. And I want to ask you, did you watch the VP debate? Did you learn anything from it? Did you learn what you wanted to learn from it? Was it more important to you than maybe previous vice presidential debates, given the age and health of the presidential candidates? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now is Ira Stoll, Boston-based editor of thefutureofcapitalism.com and author of the book JFK, Conservative. Ira, welcome to Radio Boston.
Happy to be here.
And Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend Mariama, welcome back.
Good to be here.
So I'm going to ask each of you the same question to start, and that's the same question we just asked the listeners. What did you learn from last night's debate? Do you have a headline? Ira, let's have you go first.
Well, it was a pretty dramatic contrast from the presidential debate, which was kind of a pro wrestling match where the candidates kept interrupting each other and the moderator was sort of overpowered by the huge personality of President Trump, who can be erratic and unpredictable and rough around the edges. Last night, Vice President Pence was more controlled, so disciplined as to be almost robotic. I think the emblematic moment of the debate, which admittedly is hard to translate into radio, was when a fly came by and landed on Vice President Pence's head. Now, this wasn't just a flyby by this fly. The fly actually camped out in the vice president's hair for, it seemed like a long time. I mean, long enough for the fly to have to pay monthly rent, not just a daily hotel fee or something. And Pence didn't even acknowledge that the fly was there. He didn't swat at it. He didn't let his eyes. It was almost like he was made of wax. And, you know, that can cut both ways because he could seem almost hard to relate to. But I think for people who were unsettled by the presidential debate, it seemed almost like this was a relief that there was someone who was a little more in control of himself out there on the debate stage.
So, Reverend Mariama, other than the incredibly still fly that proved that's really what the internet was paying attention to, if nothing else, what did you learn from last night's debate?
Well, my takeaway about the fly is that he must have had a lot of gel or hairspray on, because if that was the case, maybe he couldn't feel the fly. That was just my assessment. But on the whole, it was clearly less of a debacle than the previous. I actually had a slightly different reaction to Pence, and it's interesting. So I think on the whole, he did what he needed to do. There were a lot of questions that he could not provide an honest answer to without looking bad. And I think he did a good job of just not answering the questions he didn't want to answer. And, you know, while as a voter, I might not have liked that, I'll say as a debate performance that I think he did a pretty good job in saying what he wanted to say and not answering what he didn't want to. That being said, I particularly as a woman, thought he was pretty rude in the way that he never paid attention to the moderator. I happen to know that they usually have, a timing clock in there. So he knew when his time was up and he just chose not to stop talking. Times when he came and asked direct questions to Kamala Harris. So from my perspective, I thought he was a bit bullish. Clearly, when you hold him up against Donald Trump, he looks tame. But were I in a conversation with him, I would have had to say, I need you to pull it together and let's have a more civil dialogue. And I thought I might be the only one. I did check around. I had a good conversation with a friend of mine, older white male, and he said, no, that's actually, I asked him for his overall perspective and he noticed the same thing. So I don't know, maybe that plays well with his base. I was interested to see how that played with older voters who they're trying to reattract, how it played with other women voters. But yeah, for me, I think his answers were good, but his demeanor, while clearly better than President Trump, was frustrating.
Listeners, if you want to join this conversation, whether it's to tell us how you named the fly or to reflect on the procedure and the presentation of these two vice presidential candidates or what it means given the new news about debate today, call and join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There is a lot of substance I want to get into, but on this short news cycle in which we now live, we have new news today, which is that next week's presidential debate, first it was moved to virtual, then the president said, well, I won't participate in a virtual debate. Then there were a number of back and forths about, okay, do we move that one? And if so, then the president wants another one. And Joe Biden says, I don't want a third one on October 29th. Lots of kerfuffle and back and forth today. It calls into question what will happen in the presidential debate. And I want to ask you, Ira, as a result, does it make the impressions and the answers from last night more important even than, given that these are two people who are a heartbeat away from a presidency with two presidents who are two of the oldest candidates in history and one is infected with the coronavirus?
Yeah, well, the moderator, Susan Page, actually asked that question, kind of if they were prepared to step in as president, and asked them if they, because their running mates were both so old and in Trump's case had been hospitalized the weekend before, if they'd had a conversation about what happens if they are unable to be president, if, you know, in what circumstances the vice president would kind of push to take over or step in. And, you know, I think for both of them, viewers could probably come away somewhat reassured. We've talked a bit about Vice President Pence. We haven't really talked much about Kamala Harris. And I actually saw her during the Democratic primary campaign in person in New Hampshire and watched a lot of Democratic primary debates where she was there on the stage. And I think she upped her game considerably from what she was doing as a Democratic presidential candidate. And she seemed confident and in control last night. Mariama mentioned that Vice President Pence talked through the moderator. But Kamala Harris also had quite a commanding presence when Pence tried to talk over her. She had this phrase, "I am speaking," and it was very clear, "Don't mess with me" sort of message. And you know, I was just sort of intimidated watching it in my living room. people were joking about using that around their house, you know, with their kids. "I am speaking." So I think if this is the last we see from the vice presidential candidates for a while, people will come away with probably more confidence than they did beforehand about the capabilities of both these candidates.
I'm gonna run to the phones real quick, grab a couple calls, and then Reverend Mariama, I'm gonna come to you. 1-800-423-8255. Let's start with Laura in West Roxbury. Laura, go ahead.
Oh, hello, and thank you. I get furious when they do not answer the questions, and I think that the person that's in charge should say to them, "You did not answer the question," and I wouldn't give it back to them, but I would just state it as the people listening found out. And then I thought he was very rude, how he talked beyond his time, and he wasn't saying anything anyways. Oh, excuse me. You probably can tell, you know, that I'm not a real Republican. So,
well, Laura, I appreciate the call. And if you don't mind, I'm going to take it back from you there because I also want to get in Elon from Somerville. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I wanted
yes,
to
go
say
ahead.
That what I noticed immediately last night, and it actually happened a couple times, was that Harris had a very similar strategy as Biden did in the presidential debate, where she addressed the audience directly. At several points, she looked directly at the camera, sort of addressing the American people directly. And I thought it was particularly an effective strategy, and it served her well, and it served Biden well in addition. I think one of the particular moments that it really worked and hit home was talking about the coronavirus and talking about the economic effects.
Let's take it back from you there. Thank you for that, Ilan. So, Reverend Mariama, we have two calls there, both talking about frustrations or being impressed with the stylistic choices, the way the candidates chose to answer the questions. I also want to pick up on what Iris said, which he talked about the question they got asked about, essentially the presidential succession of power if each president was potentially sick. I was actually struck by the fact that I felt they didn't answer that question. Neither of them did. Mm-hmm. And to Laura's point, was there an obligation with a question that important in this moment? Should they have been forced to? And was there any way to force either of them to take that head on?
Yeah. I think neither of them did answer it. And I think I would have been surprised had they done so. I mean, I think at the end of the day, the job of the vice president is usually really to be partially a cheerleader for the presidential candidate. And so you don't want to really draw attention to anything that looks like weakness. I wish we lived in a different kind of political world where folks could just be more frank, and where we as voters rewarded people for being more frank. But, you know, unfortunately, I mean, I think this is true in races. Like, we don't always really want you to tell us the full truth. We sort of want you to make us feel good. So I wasn't exactly surprised that they didn't answer that. But I wish they would, because I would like to know that that is the case. It seems for me particularly pressing that, you know, Vice President Pence and President Trump should have had that conversation, you know, in the last week or so. So I would have loved to know that that was
another thing. So let's get into some specific topics. And I have said before that somebody I spoke with at one point said the coronavirus is not the gorilla in the room, it's the room. And it was sort of the room for the conversation last night, too. I want to play an exchange early in the night between the two vice presidential candidates over the handling of the pandemic.
President Trump and I trust the American people to make choices in the best interest of their health. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris consistently talk about mandates, and not just mandates with the coronavirus, but a government takeover of health care.
Thank you.
Green New Deal, all government control. We're about freedom and respecting the freedom of the American people.
Let's talk about respecting the American people. You respect the American people when you tell them the truth. You respect the American people when you have the courage to be a leader speaking of those things that you may not want people to hear, but they need to hear so they can protect themselves.
Ira, I saw a lot of people respond in social media pretty immediately to the vice president's choice to frame that as a question about freedom of and trust of the American people versus the behaviors and choices of the administration. Did that sell for you?
Well, look, the Trump administration is in a difficult spot with this coronavirus because, as Harris repeatedly pointed out, more than 200,000 people have died. You know, it was a little like Bush running for re-election during the Iraq War, except the casualties there were much smaller. So, you know, they're trying different responses to that. Trump tried, well, we're going to have a vaccine real soon, and we're doing a great job with the vaccine. Pence's approach of saying, well, actually, like, Americans have been really brave and working hard to fight this. And if you're saying that the Trump administration is doing a bad job on the virus, what you're really doing is you're attacking all the nurses and emergency room doctors you know, people trying to keep their businesses open. And you know, he doesn't have a lot of great cards to play on the virus, at least until there's a vaccine approved, or if the situation worsens in Europe as it is. Like, I would have liked to see Pence say, well, you know, the case fatality ratio is worse in Spain and France, and President Trump isn't the president there. So, you know, how do you account for that? Maybe even they've got national health care there the way you want to bring it here.
So, Ira, let me pick up. I want to pick up on that for a second. I have a little more sound to play because you mentioned the vaccine twice, and I do want to pick up on that. I want to do a back and forth here. First, Kamala Harris on the fact that she doesn't trust a vaccine that only the president vouches for.
If the public health professionals, if Dr. Fauci, if the doctors tell us that we should take it, I'll be the first in line to take it. Absolutely. But if Donald Trump tells us that we should take it, I'm not taking it.
And Vice President Mike Pence pushed back on her, saying that she was undermining efforts to fight the virus.
The fact that you continue to undermine public confidence in a vaccine, if the vaccine emerges during the Trump administration, I think is unconscionable. And Senator, I just ask you, stop playing politics with people's lives.
I was very interested in that exchange, Reverend Mariama. You know, again, Ira made a couple of references to it already. I felt like there was a little bit of a role reversal in some of the messaging there, and I wasn't entirely sure if there's a way to know kind of who won, quote unquote, the exchange about the vaccine. I'd be interested in your reactions.
So I will give Pence credit. I think that he had, he's working with a terrible hand about coronavirus. And I think, to be honest with you, I thought he played the best he could from a sort of political perspective. That being said, did it convince me or anybody else? Not so sure, because, I mean, the hand he was dealt was pretty bad. I think in terms of the vaccine, I think it is super complex. In all transparency, I am part of one of the vaccines trials, and I've had conversations with my congregants, and quite a few of them are concerned about taking the vaccine. And one of them said to me, she said, I'm not against science. I'm just concerned about big pharma and human beings and the politics of this. So I think that Kamala Harris's response, I think, aligns with where many folks in the country are. But I do think that Pence's pivot did the best he could to try to undermine that and strengthen his hand. So I think on the facts on the ground, he should have lost that outright. I was a little surprised that she didn't name that he is running the COVID task force. So it's not even just President Trump's fault. This is one she could have pinned squarely on him. That didn't quite happen. So
I want to get one more caller voice in before we run out of time, and we are close to the end here. But we've got Chris on the line from Hyde Park. Chris, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So the idea I had was maybe there should be live fact-checking happening, at least on the TV version of the debates. Whoever handles the fact-checking, it's a lot of logistics, I know. But if they had that happening real time, at least then the viewer would have a sense rather than have to sort of read the next day who told more of the truth than not. And I'll take the rest on the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that, Chris. We have about 30 seconds left. So, Ira, very briefly, did we get a good exchange of facts last night? Briefly.
Yeah. I think the internet makes it possible for people to go to a lot of sources and check the facts or we check the facts here on the radio. I don't know that it's a little bit of a heavy ask for the debate moderators to do that in real time because.
All right. I got to take it back from you there, Ira. Ira, I'm so sorry. That's Ira Stoll, a future of capitalism.com, and Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thanks so much to both of you. What is it like to care for older adults during this pandemic?
It's been tough because the family can't come in to see them. They have to stay at a distance now, speak to my clients through the door. That's the difficult part because my clients, when they are dementia, they don't understand how come their family can't come inside the house.
That's Elizabeth Davis, a home care worker in Springfield, Greenfield, and Amherst. We spoke with her as part of our series, Living Through Corona, about our neighbors' experiences during this global pandemic. A home care worker for 35 years, Elizabeth has particularly vulnerable clients. They're in their 90s. And with the pandemic, she has had to change how she works.
A lot of them are surprised when they come in, they see me, and I'm all masked up and gloved up. And sometimes they say, well, you don't have to have your mask on. But I do. I don't know from my travels back and forth if I'm carrying the COVID or if they have it, so I'm protecting them. and protecting myself.
Does it scare them, especially those clients who have dementia, to see you look so different in your personal protective equipment?
Yes, it's very difficult for them because most of them are deaf, and over the years, they're able to read lips. So we have to stand back, pull the mask down, and speak to them where they can read our lips. We just can't be comfortable in taking care of them. We have to make sure that we use all the precautions, constantly washing our hands each time we touch them or glove up. And we're still looking for PPE.
How are you getting the PPE that you need?
Well, in the beginning, I had a coworker. Her family member were making the cotton mask. And I started out wearing the cotton mask. And then surgical masks were coming to me, but maybe four masks in a pack from my agency, which is still not enough. And I began to wash those out and use them two or three times. But I'm in a need for PPE, plenty of it, because the way that this COVID-19 is going, we're going to have it for a couple of years.
You are almost 70, which means you're high risk yourself. You know, I find myself wondering, what's it like for you each day as you sort of approach the front door of a client's home, aware of both their vulnerabilities and yours?
I know that they don't have COVID, but we have different aides that go in and out with my clients. So when I come in there, I be on guard at all times because you never know.
What's at stake for you if you get sick, Elizabeth?
Well, because I'm high risk, it would be very frightening for me because I think about my family members. If I really got sick and they couldn't come and see me, you know, it would be horrible, terrible.
Have you been able to see your loved ones and your family members?
I've talked to them over the phone, but to get together like we normally would do, for our family gatherings, our family reunions, we couldn't do that.
That's got to be hard.
It is very hard. It's very, very hard because I'm so used to seeing my family in person.
How are you keeping yourself whole, mentally whole, emotionally whole? You know, where are you getting the psychological hugs from when you can't be with your own family?
What I have been doing is listening to comedy. And comedy has put me in a place where I'm not stressed out. I can laugh, and they always say laughter is a good medicine. I'm not always into myself. My compassion is not going inward, but it's outward. So I empty myself of myself, and I take care of my client.
What's your favorite source of comedy?
Oh, you probably, Trevor Noah, you know him?
Absolutely.
He is hilarious.
Of the Daily Show.
The Daily, Distant Daily Show now. He can take a sad moment and make it to a happy moment. Not where it pulls you down, but it gives you uplift. That's why I love listening to him.
You talked about emptying yourself to do this work. Does the work empty you, or do you feel the need to empty yourself of yourself in order to do your work?
I feel the need to empty myself so I can do the work, because if I didn't do that, then I wouldn't take care of my clients.
Do you see yourself as a frontline worker?
Yes, I do. But to my community and to my representative, I'm invisible, and we need to be recognized. I need to be recognized as a frontline worker.
What makes you feel invisible?
I'm constantly hearing on TV, radio, they talk about frontline workers as those who work in the hospital, first responder, police officers, but never hear about home care workers. I feel at a low point, like no one cares about me and my work.
What could our communities do to better recognize and support the work that you're doing as a home care worker?
I would like to see our community back us up, rallying for us, that We need to be recognized, but not only to be recognized, we need livable wages. We at like the lowest wage rate right now. And I don't think that's equal. I don't think it's fair. Look like our representatives are marginalized our work. And it's important. Some of us is just barely making it on the wages that they're paying us through the home care agencies. I have to work a lot of hours to make ends meet.
You were recently featured, Elizabeth, on a billboard. It's part of a campaign for your union, SEIU 1199. The billboard was to highlight the role of home care workers in fighting COVID and racism, and it read, quote, "Home care workers are fighting to be seen and heard because our lives matter," end quote. What does it mean for you to be seen and heard right now, both as a home care worker and as a Black woman?
I would love to see that our representatives take note in our work and to uplift us and to provide us with equal pay, equality. We are not recognized. We're not seen, and we're not being heard.
I know Governor Baker proclaimed September 4th, this year, 2020, as Home Care Day, in recognition of the work that home care workers do. Is that a step in the right direction? Is that the kind of recognition you want?
Yes, it's a step, but we are not quite there yet. They need to talk policy about us and about our work.
Elizabeth, has the pandemic changed you in any fundamental way? And if so, what is that?
Sometimes I think that one end is a blessing for me because I can still continue to care for my clients. That's what it's done for me. And I'm driven by this pandemic to do better and to know better. And I better serve my client right now because I'm really on my P's and Q's with them.
That's Elizabeth Davis, a home caregiver who works in Springfield, Amherst, and Greenfield. Elizabeth, really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much. And you be safe. Noah Trevor says, be positive and test negative.
I will work on both. And really, please take care of yourself. Take good care.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. We have engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.